Dr. Wolf also commented on two key ASCO presentations on cardiotoxicity with anthracyclines in the adjuvant setting.
What Sharon Giordano did with colleagues at MD Anderson was a population-based observation study looking at the SEER Medicare database, including women over the age of 65, women ages 66 through 90, diagnosed with breast cancer from 1992 to 1999 with no other cancer, no history of CHF. And they ultimately identified about 31,000 women and separated those patients in three groups. A group that received no chemotherapy, 27,000 women. A group that received non-intracycline chemotherapy, about 2,300 people. And the remaining group, 1,600 women who received intracycline-based chemotherapy. And what they did observe, they separated the analysis in two specific groups, ages 66 through 70 and ages 71 through 90. And the mean age of these women were 75, with a median follow-up of 68. And the older women had more comorbidities, less chemotherapy, and the patients who received doxorubicin had higher risk tumors. And what they did observe when they look at the 10-year outcome in terms of the diagnosis of CHF using ICD-9 codes, they observed that women who did not receive chemotherapy had a 73% chance of being free of diagnosis of CHF. Women who received chemotherapy with organotetracycline had a 74% similar chance of being free of congestive heart failure, while women who received an intracycline-based chemotherapy regimen had only a 61% chance of being free of a diagnosis of CHF. So about a 13% absolute difference at 10 years for the women who receive an intracycline. And when they look at the individual comorbidities, factors such as hypertension, diabetes mellitus, coronary artery disease, and peripheral vascular disease were quite significant in identifying patients at risk. They look at the age 71 through 90 group, and they saw no difference. And the question was whether there was a selection bias, whether these patients, if they were receiving intracycline, were receiving lower doses of chemotherapy. They had no access to the individual records for these patients.
If you can comment on the Shepherd paper.
The Shepherd paper was an analysis of the MA5 study, which is a study with 710 women, pre- and perimenopause with node-positive breast cancer, who received CEF with a cumulative dose of epirubicin of 720 milligrams per meter square, or CMF without an intracycline. And these women had a very strict follow-up as far as LVEF, which was measured on both arms at baseline, at 6 months, 12 months, 36, and 60 months. And they were looking at changes in cardiac function on the basis of ejection fraction. And what they did observe at the end of 60 months was that ultimately 25% of the women treated with CEF had at least a 10% absolute drop in ejection fraction, while approximately 9.5% of the women treated with CMF had at least a 10% drop. When they look at the women with a drop greater than 20%, it was 5% in the CEF group and less than 1% in the CMF group. What is interesting is that when you look at a number of women that they would have hoped to test at 60 months and how many women actually had LVEF testing, was only about 40%. So there were 60% of patients who did not make it to the LVEF assessment. And whether that in any way was related to comorbidities or complications, toxicities that may have prevented them from going into assessment and could actually have favored the less toxicity arm. What was also interesting, two other points they made, was in terms of the number of women with a LVEF drop below 50%, assuming that 50% would be expected to be normal. It was normal in most institutions. It was 17% for the CEF group, and it was 2% for the CMF group. So the question is how much of that is truly meaningful in the long run in terms of symptoms. So if you look at the absolute number of women who developed CHF, grade 3, 4, among the women who had a drop in EF greater than 20%, there were only 4 cases with CHF in the CEF group and no cases in the CMF group, which brings the point of what exactly is the long-term meaning of these drops in ejection fractions if most of them are being asymptomatic. We knew this from the Milan data from a couple of years ago, comparing patients treated with epirubicin at a dose of 300 per meter square versus CMF, that about 8% of these patients would have evidence of diastolic dysfunction in the epirubicin group compared to essentially no patients in the CMF group. And if you think about whether that should or not impact your treatment of these patients, is the question of whether the potential improvement in survival offered by this specific therapy substantially outweigh, at this point for most patients, the asymptomatic changes in cardiac function that may or may not have long-term implications.
Greg?
Well, I think we have to be very careful with the data we just saw. First of all, the second presentation, the one from Shepherd, I find very compelling, and that would be the basis of my recommendations. Ideally, these numbers should be risk-adjusted. I don't think they did that, but you made the point, Antonio, and I think you made it correctly, that your chances of surviving to that point should adjust your actual calculation of risk. And so the numbers could change. The first one, however, I think is very misleading. And I say that because I've looked at lots and lots of CRFs. And evaluated both SAEs and AEs, and I find it fascinating how, given a constellation of symptoms, a physician will assign a cause or attribute it to a cause and will work the patient up. How they go about working the patient up will vary enormously by the background. So when there's cancer there, there's kind of a tendency to always assume that whatever the patient has is related to cancer. If there's a drug there, to always assume it's related to the drug. And you say, well, this is just asking whether they have congestive heart failure or not. But you first of all have the question, why are you working the patient up or diagnosing congestive heart failure? Congestive heart failure is not such a straightforward thing. First of all, the patient comes in with shortness of breath, a DOE or whatever it is, and then what steps are you going to take? Oftentimes it may be mild. You may not, in fact, give it a full workup and so on. So I think the first one has real problems with the SEER database for this kind of an analysis and probably distorts the answer seriously. The second one, Shepherd, I think gives us a better estimate of what the actual pattern is.
Another interesting poll question we posed to the faculty was based on the case of a 60-year-old woman with well-controlled hypertension in whom adjuvant chemotherapy with an anthracycline is being considered. We asked the faculty what they would tell such a patient about the risk of anthracycline-related cardiomyopathy, and the results range from 0.5% to 10%. I asked Dr. Henderson what he would say.
I used about 2% as what my estimate would be. I don't know what to do with the decrease in 50%. I think you need to explain that to the patient. I think you need to give both of those numbers. Obviously, congestive heart failure is the important one, but with the high frequency of LVEF, the story isn't over yet. And you have to assume that probably if you follow these patients another 10 years, that 1% is going to become 2 or 3%.
Hope?
But again, I think there are comorbid conditions that contribute, which are hard. I agree completely with your comments about the first analysis, although it was a great analysis in terms of stimulating studies of patients we can actually track and we know what medical problems they had. It's not definitive because of the problems you mentioned. In terms of what you would tell a patient, I'm still unclear about whether or not we would tell somebody who's getting 4 cycles of AC based on the epirubicin data that they have a higher than 1% rate of cardiac damage. I mean, I don't know that we know how to judge the cardiac damage risk, and well-controlled mild hypertension, again, we're not sure that that as a pre-existing condition increases your long-term risks of CHF from an anthracycline. It may increase your risks of getting CHF. We don't know that from the Medicare database yet, so it still seems to me that 1% is a reasonable number, and I would be curious as to what people would tell that patient, because we were all across the board there.
Chuck, I view you as the cardio-oncologist here. What are your thoughts on this?
I had answered 0.5% based on the NSABP tox tables, and assuming that by heart failure you mean 3-4 heart failure, not I'm a little dyspneic and my EF is 48. I mean, that's a key question to answering that. What exactly do you mean by heart failure? And the 0.5% is grade 3-4 toxicity, and that's consistently around 0.5% with AC times 4. And I do think that that was 720 per meter of epirubicin, so it shouldn't be extrapolated down. But I have been telling patients for a long time, since I was watching the B31 cardiac data on what happened with AC Taxol, that their chances of having drops in their ejection fraction that we would have some concerns about, just recognizing that it is a real drop. I've been telling them that's probably up there around 5 or 6%. So this is why I like that we're backing off chemo in our node negatives, because I've been worrying about all the anthracyclines we throw at ER-positive patients for some time.
Antonio?
The beautiful presentation that Richard Steingart, the cardiologist who commented on these two presentations, and actually it was a little bit of an eye-opener for some things that we more or less knew in the back of our minds. We tend to focus a lot on systolic function. We tend to focus a lot on the number, which is something we can measure, and even a cardiologist sometimes will focus on the number. What he reminded us is that essentially, among older women, diastolic dysfunction is much more of an issue than systolic function. So you can have women with congestive heart failure with evidence of diastolic dysfunction and normal EF. And in fact, 2/3 of the women, according to him, with congestive heart failure will have normal ejection fraction. And that is because the main cause of CHF in this population is hypertension. So you could have a woman with hypertension and normal EF, could have evidence of diastolic dysfunction, who could have a much greater risk of developing complications associated with the anthracycline.
You know, the extension of that is the whole issue has sensitized me to what limited information we have about this long-term risk. And in the Women's Health Initiative, we're very cognizant of how difficult it is to measure congestive heart failure. We've got prospective studies, a $722 million budget. We've got cardiac primary endpoints, and we are not confident in our ability to define congestive heart failure. And we get these clinical reports and the numbers, and it's really pretty much, I think many cardiologists would have a difficult time with these diagnoses.
The next paper was discussed by Dr. Joyce O'Shaughnessy, a study from her group, U.S. Oncology, and principal investigator Dr. Steve Jones, comparing the docetaxel cyclophosphamide TC regimen to AC.
This was a little bit of a gutsy study that Steve started back in 1997, because at the time he started this randomized trial, there was only really phase 1-2 data from Vincente Valero at MD Anderson looking at TC in metastatic disease. But the indications were that the taxanes were blockbuster agents, and so at that time, a two-drug regimen was standard. So it was a randomized trial, as you know, to the AC standard for 4 cycles versus the TC with the docetaxel at 75, keeping the cyclophosphamide in the same duration of therapy. The bottom line on disease-free survival, which was the primary endpoint, was that with mature follow-up now at 5 years, 86% with TC and 80% with AC for a hazard of 0.67 and a P of 0.015. I've been so interested in this whole issue of ER positive and what does chemotherapy do and et cetera. And I've been concerned that we've been not really looking enough at the progesterone receptor. There's a difference in the biology between ER PR positive and ER positive PR negative. So without Steve knowing about it, I asked the statistician to just look at the next analysis. If we just look, the TC is better than the AC in the ER PR positive by about 5 percentage points. This is out at 60 months. But in the ER-positive, PR-negative, there is this trend towards the TC being substantially better. Now, again, very tiny numbers, hypothesis generating, but I think of the PR-negative disease, as we all do, as growth factor-driven breast cancer. And it's interesting with what Dan Hay showed us at ASCO with the paclitaxel really being beneficial in the HER2-positives. Of course, some of these ER-positive, PR-negatives will be HER2-positive, but there are undoubtedly other growth factor pathways that are collaborating with the ER to drive PR negative breast cancer. And it's just interesting to me to look at the taxane, and again, in this very, very hypothesis-generating subset. Overall survival, a 3 percentage point absolute improvement at 5 years in favor of the TC, the hazard 0.76. It's trending towards significant, but not statistically significant. So Steve's concluding slide was that TC should now be considered as a standard non-anthracycline adjuvant regimen for operable breast cancer patients. And in my practice now, I don't use the AC anymore just as a 4-cycle regimen. I've switched over to the TC so that when I'm going to just use 4 cycles for a lower risk ER positive, node negative patient, for example, I will use the TC based on these data. And that's been sort of emphasized to me now coming out of ASCO with the longer term look at the cardiac toxicity.
Thanks, Joyce. I'd like to Boo and Peter to comment on the question of TC. And actually, the reason I'm picking you is both of you participated in a project we did a couple years ago where we did several, quote, town meetings of breast cancer survivors and gave them keypads and had you guys and a bunch of other faculty from around the country present different issues and questions. And one of the things that came out about this was we asked people to rate potential side effects and complications of chemotherapy after hearing what you all were describing in terms of what the risks were. We were very surprised that concerns about cardiotoxicity were among the most highly rated, much more highly rated in alopecia and other problems, which was interesting in view of the numbers that were presented to these people. So, Debu, what are your thoughts about non-anthracycline regimens, and do you agree or disagree with Joyce's contention that TC now is a better therapy than AC?
Well, cardiac issues are clearly important. I think we underestimate them after decades of attention to heart disease in this country. It's no surprise that patients are concerned about this. So we do need less cardiotoxic regimens. Just by way of covering the prior material, we really don't know the long-term history for cardiac toxicity because we've never measured it systematically, and it's a hard thing to measure anyway. So I think when you look at population-based studies, you may overestimate it because there are probably a lot of misclassified people. And then I think when you look at clinical trials, you may underestimate it because of selection bias of patients that you enroll on studies. So either way, it's a hard thing to determine. I do think that the TC regimen is a reasonable non-anthracycline regimen. It's a smaller study, so our level of confidence in this is less, but at least everything was in the right direction. So I do think that despite all the limitations of being a small study and also one that was spread out over a large period of time and had very broad eligibility criteria, I still think that it did show that it's as good or probably even better than AC. And I think that in patients with cardiac risk factors, it's a totally reasonable regimen to use.
Could I ask you, patients who don't have cardiac risk factors, do you think that that's a regimen that should be brought up as an option?
I think it can be. When you look at the overall toxicity profile, it's hard for me to figure out which was better tolerated because the spectrum of toxicities were different. The TC regimen had more hematologic toxicities, more edema, whereas the AC regimen had more GI toxicities and cardiotoxicity, presumably, although I don't know how well that was
measured. There was one CHF in the AC and zero in the TC, and we really didn't do a lot of monitoring.
Peter, what's your take on this?
I think that if we'd started with TC, we wouldn't be going across to AC on the results of this trial. And I think that the trial is of modest size but shows statistically significant disease-free survival. And consistent with that, the same size overall survival, it's just underpowered for it to make statistical significance. So I would anticipate that over the next couple of years, people that want to give a short 12-week regimen are going to be giving TC much more frequently over time than was given a year ago. About the cardiac toxicity, I agree that the SEER analysis matched with Medicare records wasn't absolutely convincing. Amongst other things, the numbers seemed very high to me. And I would have liked to have known in just a general population what those numbers actually are anticipated to be. I think that we have a major problem with ascertainment, however, of late toxicity in clinical trials. And if I have a patient that had developed congestive heart failure, had been treated by somebody, by just our internist who'd put her on some kind of mild congestive medicine, I'm not sure I would necessarily always pick that up. And I think that's the kind of thing that isn't picked up on long-term toxicity reports. There's one paper that hasn't been mentioned here in this regard, and that is, it's my understanding that in MUSS's analysis of the older patients in CLGB studies, there wasn't a marked increase in congestive failure, but I don't know how long the follow-up was on average for those patients. So that's somewhat reassuring that we're not way out of whack for the older patients.
Hope.
I think that some of the considerations have to be added toxicity. So, for example, you have the cardiac risk, which obviously is going to be somewhat age-related and morbidity-related, even if we don't have all of the data for that. But also, there is a known risk of secondary leukemias and myelodysplasia. And so the more we use chemotherapy in lower-risk patients, as Rowan was saying earlier, as a standard of care, the more concern we need to have about inappropriately giving toxicity. So if there is a regimen which can eliminate that risk and have with docetaxel relatively modest risk of peripheral neuropathy, another very bothersome side effect, then that's great. Now, the TC regimen, they didn't use growth factors, although I think that was one of the bigger toxicities was neutropenia. And we certainly, when we started using TC, we had our first hospitalizations in a very long time for febrile neutropenia. And so I think that you have to be cautious in individual patients and monitor maybe perhaps closely. Perhaps those are the patients who should receive prophylactic antibiotics. And then the last comment is just, we saw a lot of data on the last day of ASCO on Topo 2, some of it conflicting, and the role of anthracyclines in patients who have Topo 2, perhaps probably mutations more than deletions. In a study of this size, we might not be able to see that impact. You don't have enough patients in each arm, potentially. So now, with that data on Topo 2, do we all feel equally comfortable using TC across the board? Do we need to have information on Topo 2?